From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The Simpsons, like Fresh Air, is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. Today, we hear from creator Matt Groening. He says after they once did a parody of the Fox News Channel on The Simpsons, the Fox Network, which carries the show, made a new rule.
We can't do those little fake news crawls on the bottom of the screen in a cartoon because it might confuse the viewers into thinking it's real news.
We also hear from two of the show's original writers, the composer behind the music and songs, and some of the actors, including Nancy Cartwright, whom Groening cast as Bart.
I gave him one take, one voice, and that was it. Blah, 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 blah. And Matt, his eyebrows went up. He's like, oh, my God, that's Bart. That's him. You got the part.
Also, David Edelstein reviews Alien Covenant. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Fresh Air and The Simpsons have something in common. We're both celebrating our 30th anniversary. It's been 30 years since The Simpsons were introduced to America in a series of animated shorts on The Tracy Ullman Show, a brand new variety series on a brand new TV network called Fox. That was in 1987. 3 years later, The Simpsons had their own show, which has been running ever since. Today, we'll listen back to interviews with some of the show's cast members, writer-producers, and music composers. But we'll start where The Simpsons started, with cartoonist Matt Groening. He was the creator of the underground comic strip Life in Hell and was approached by The Tracy Ullman Show to devise some sort of short cartoon sequences that could serve as bumpers or separators between the show's other disconnected sketches. As he explained to Terry Gross in 2003, he created an entire family, a family that eventually would fit nicely into its own sitcom format. In this early season episode, a local children's TV host, Krusty the Clown, is invited for a meal at the Simpsons dinner table.
Who wants to say grace?
Why don't we let our guests do it?
Krusty, would you do the honors?
Well, all right, I'm a little rusty, but I'll try. Baruch ata Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, hamotzi lechem min haaretz.
Oh, he's talking funny talk.
No, Dad, that's Hebrew. Krusty must be Jewish.
A Jewish entertainer? Get out of here.
Dad, there are many prominent Jewish entertainers, including Lauren Bacall, Don Shore, William Shatner, and Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks is Jewish?
I want to ask you about some of the characters that didn't exist in the very beginning stages of The Simpsons, starting with Krusty the Clown, who's this really funny character. I mean, he's basically like an old vaudevillian type. He's kind of really bitter and Jewish, like a lot of comics, and but this is like an old style Jewish comic dash clown. What did you think of Krusty when he was first created?
Well, Krusty was based on a TV show clown who I grew up with in Portland, Oregon, named Rusty Nails. Rusty Nails was a Christian clown. He was he had his own show, and he showed old Three Stooges shorts. And he was great, and he wasn't like Krusty at all. He was very nice guy, and a very sweet clown. But he had that name, Rusty Nails, which I found incredibly disturbing as a child. Because, you're supposed to avoid Rusty Nails. So... So the idea of a clown named Rusty Nails.
You were a sensitive little kid.
Clowns are scary to begin with. And even though this was a nice clown, I was slightly perturbed by him.
You know, we spoke just as The Simpsons was coming into existence, starting first as a Tracy Ullman series. And I think we spoke just as it was about to be broadcast on its own. And a lot has happened since then. Simpsons have taken over the world since then. I'm wondering how your vision of the characters as they are now compare with the vision you had when you were creating them.
Well, here's the problem with doing a sitcom, which has lasted more than 300 episodes, is you're trying not to repeat yourself. You're trying to surprise the audience, and you're trying to keep... everybody works on the show surprised. As a result, the show has gone off in some very peculiar directions. Sometimes I was alarmed. I was going, oh, my God, we can't do this. We can't do this. And then it turns out to be okay. One of the great things we did last year was we parodied the Fox News Channel. And we did the crawl along the bottom of the screen. Uh-huh. And Fox fought against it and said that they would sue. They would sue the show, and we called their bluff because we didn't think Rupert Murdoch would pay for Fox to sue itself. So we got away with it. But now Fox has a new rule that we can't do those little fake news crawls on the bottom of the screen in a cartoon because it might confuse the viewers into thinking it's real news.
What are some of the other things that you have been threatened legally over or, that have been really controversial, advertisers pulling out? Because let's face it, The Simpsons does a lot of satire about homosexuality, the church, you know, violence on television?
You know, at the beginning, virtually anything we did would get somebody upset. And now it seems like people who are eager to be offended, and this country is full of people who are eager to be offended, they've given up on our show. We got into trouble a few years ago for Homer's watching an anti-drinking commercial, and it said, warning, beer causes rectal cancer. And Homer responds by saying, beer. Fox didn't want us to do that because beer advertisers are a big part of the Fox empire. And it turns out that the writer was able to track down the actual fact where some study showed that indeed it does or did or has a tendency to. So we were able to keep that in. But they want, that's the kind of thing we put up with.
Let's talk about Itchy and Scratchy. And this is the recurring cartoon that Bart and Lisa watch on TV. And it's the kind of like super violent version of all the cat and mouse kind of cartoons. How'd you come up with this?
Well, it was from watching cat and mouse cartoons growing up. Pixie and Dixie, the Hanna-Barbera mice, and Tom and Jerry in particular. Very, very violent and very, very funny cartoons, MGM cartoons. And the fantasy was wanting these cartoons to extend their violence even more. So with Itchy and Scratchy, it's as extreme as it can get for a cat and mouse cartoon. We've done so many of them that they're harder and harder to write. And originally of the actors, Harry Shearer, a sophisticated guy, he seemed to laugh the hardest at Itchy and Scratchy during the table reads. I don't know if he's the voice of Itchy or Scratchy, but he's the voice of one of them. He talks like that. Dan Castellaneta is the voice of the other one.
So were you in on the writing of the Itchy and Scratchy theme song?
Yeah, well, yeah, that was obvious. It's by the way, it's not, everybody thinks it's they fight and fight and fight and fight and fight. It's not. It's they fight and bite and fight and fight and bite.
Well, I think it's time to hear the Itchy and Scratchy theme song. Let's hear it.
The lyrics to that were written by Sam Simon, one of the original producers who developed the show, along with Jim Brooks, and basically set the tone for the show.
One of the characters is Ned Flanders. He's the Simpsons' born-again neighbor. And, you know, so the kids in the Flanders household are being brought up very differently than the kids in the Simpsons household. Can you talk about the creation of Ned Flanders?
Originally, Ned Flanders was just the wacky neighbor who was supposed to be just a complete annoyance to Homer for no good reason. And then we realized that he was an object of mirth with his strong religious feelings. We thought, how do we create a religious character who is not the usual stereotype? And we made him a truly good guy. And his beliefs are sometimes a little annoying, but he's not a hypocrite. He's real, and we get lots of fan mail for him, and we get lots of photos of people who look exactly like Ned Flanders. Some people think Michael Medved is a Ned Flanders clone. So,
because
And I love the character. Harry Shearer does the voice, and he does such a fantastic job with finding variations on Oakley Dokley. And I think we treat the character with some dignity.
Cartoonist Matt Groening, creator of The Simpsons, speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. Coming up, actress Nancy Cartwright, the voice of Bart. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We continue our 30th anniversary salute to The Simpsons by revisiting Terry's 2003 interview with Nancy Cartwright, who has been the voice of Bart Simpson from the very start. She's aged over 30 years since she started doing Bart, but Bart remains a child and Cartwright remains convincing. When Terry spoke with Cartwright in 2003, she told Terry about auditioning for The Simpsons.
So I went in and shook Matt Groening's hand, and I said, you know, I'm here to read for Lisa, but I saw the part for Bart, and I'd rather read for him. Do you mind? And he said, no, it's fine. So I gave him one shot, one take, one sound, one voice, and that was it. Blah, 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 blah. And Matt, his eyebrows went up, his tongue came out of his mouth. He's like, oh, my God, that's him, that's Bart, that's him. You got the part. And I was given the part on the spot.
So is it... There's nothing conscious going on when you do the voice. It just came to you.
Yeah. It just, no kidding. When I saw the picture, it really helps when you get the visual image of what the character looks like. Because sometimes you might have a character whose jaw is sticking out a little bit more on the bottom than it is on the top. And he's got this sort of, there's a placement there. So you know that his lower teeth would be sticking out a little bit farther. So that would help in creating a character. Or say you've got a 7-year-old kid who's got a split in his two front teeth, or he's missing one of his teeth at age 7.
So he would be talking sort of like this, and you can put a sort of a sound in there, sort of like that little actress that played on Mrs. Doubtfire.
So I can steal from, you know, Mara Wilson, I think was that little actress's name. I totally ripped that off from her. when I go to the mall or just, you know, people watching, or I go to movies and watch television, I'm inspired by live action actors and recognizing sounds and trying to duplicate that. So I come up with an arsenal of characters in my head so then I can then at the next audition give them more options.
Well, why don't you describe who Nelson is and how you came up with his voice?
Well, Nelson, he was a bad boy, and I had to read the script because there's not much of a description in the script. It might say bad boy, but it didn't go into detail on it. So by reading the script and, you know, putting that in context, I realized he was just this, he was a thug. He was bigger physically than Bart. So he was also, I believe Nelson Muntz is a little bit older, even though he's in the fourth grade. But I just ended up coming up with the sound that I think Nelson has sort of evolved, and it came to the point where he eventually got a really, really rough sound like that. And he has got a really, really hard R's. And I don't know, that's how that sound came. And the laugh, the ha-ha, let me just say it for ha-ha, that was written in the script as it just said, I think it actually just said ha-ha. And I don't know, if somebody else would have been cast as that, they would have come up with their own idea of what that would sound like. But when I did that, it got an instant laugh, and so that stuck. And because I think it got that laugh, the writers put a little asterisk or a little star beside that, and they know that later on they can do that again, and hopefully it'll continue to get a laugh. And it's through trial and error and through experimenting. I don't think anybody said, let's create a signature laugh for Nelson Muntz. Do you know what I mean? It's just something that sort of evolved. And I find that fascinating, too, in looking at the development of The Simpsons, that a lot of choices that we had the opportunity to make, they were just opportunities that we had. Nobody was going out there and saying, wow, when I do this, this is going to become a catchphrase. Next thing you know, this is smell you later, that people are going to be saying that, you know?
When you do that gruff, like, Nelson voice, does that hurt your vocal cords at all? Like, is there a way of doing that without it hurting?
You know, he truly is he's the most challenging in terms of my vocal cords, but throughout the years and the 400-plus episodes that we've done so far, Nelson has only really been a lead character or citizen in a hand, you know, in just maybe a couple or three. One of my favorite ones was when it was that tribute when he came home and Marge really kind of took him under his wing and he sang that song. It was a tribute to, it was a play on Yentl. I don't know if I can do it.
Oh.
Papa, can you hear me? He's singing to his father because his father, left to go get cigarettes or milk or something at the Quickie Mart. He never came. Papa, is that you? Is that you? Oh, Papa.
Is there ever a time when you're given a script and you're thinking, I really need to see a visual to get what's going on here, to get what Bart is actually experiencing?
Wow, that's another great question. No. Actually, no, but I think partially is that especially after all these years, we can totally visualize what's going on. But you just got to do your homework. You just got to be prepared and know that if Bart is, you know, on a skateboard or he's like riding his bicycle over a cliff and down a hill, that there's going to be you know, and I just visualize it and like, how many seconds of this do you want? Well, make it a little bit longer. Do it again, but make it longer. And Nancy, you know what? This isn't a show about him riding, you know, his bicycle over a cliff. Just cut it. Like, you got to cut that about, just give me about a tenth of that. Yeah, okay, good. No problem. Because I don't know about the length of time for the animation.
You said earlier that, you know, when like a lot of friends of yours who have children or, you know, people you're just meeting who have children will introduce the kids to you and say, this is Nancy Cartwright, and she does the voice of Bart. And then they'll expect you to do the voice of Bart for the kids. What about your own kids? I mean, they grew up while you were doing The Simpsons. Did they do like Mommy, Mommy, do Bart for us?
As a parent, you kind of wonder what kind of influence you have on your kids in everything that you're doing, whether it's traveling, you know, to different countries or whatever. But when my son Jack was 2 years old, they had come out with a Bart Simpson. It was a prototype to see if the talking Bart doll would work. But the string on the thing was a little short, so it sort of sounded like Bart on helium, because it would be like, don't have a cow, man. Don't have a cow, man. But my son would pull the string, and it would say that, and he'd look at the string, and then he'd look at me. He'd pull it again, don't have a cow, man, and he'd look at me, and he'd said to me, Mommy, I don't see you in there. I don't see you in there. He's 2 years old. I'm telling you, that is a concept. Parents will come up to me, and you know, I know that they want to hear me do the voice, but there's a three-year-old clutching onto Mama's skirt, and they're saying, could you do it for Sally? Could you do it? And I'm thinking, I'll just tell the parent, I don't have anything vested in this for a three-year-old kid that looks scared to death. If I was to lean down and say, hi, I'm Bart Simpson. Who the hell are you? You think that kid is going to like it? The kids look at me like I'm, you know, an alien, or they get upset. So I'll just say, look, I'll do it for you, but I'm not going to do it for your child. I just think that that's wrong.
Why do the kids get so upset?
Well, it's too big of a concept. They're looking at this woman who, they might watch The Simpsons, but a child, I really think that they are watching it through a child's eyes, and they enjoy the colors and they like the different expressions and emotions that they see. Whereas a teenager will cull something totally different out of that. They will start to recognize references. And of course, adults, I mean, we can get the satire and we can get more, you know, of history and even more references than a teenager would get. So there's a whole cross-generational span of The Simpsons that entertains those audiences. But a kid, I don't know, man. I don't know how old I was before I realized that those sounds came from actors. It's a concept that's pretty, you know, I'd say five and under. Just, this is a gross generalization. There are exceptions to the rule, no doubt about it. But generally speaking, I use some discretion on who I just throw that voice to.
Well, Nancy Cartwright, it's just been so much fun to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, you bet.
Actress Nancy Cartwright speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. For 30 years, Nancy has played Bart Simpson. And for just as long, our next guest, Julie Kavner, has provided the voice of Bart's mother, Marge Simpson. Terry spoke with her in 1994.
So how do you change your voice to become Marge?
I roughen it up and I raise it a bit. I raise it an octave or so.
Can you do a little more?
Oh, it's just kind of up there like that and a little more tired.
Right. Now, does it hurt your voice to do that?
Not at all. The sisters, on the other hand, the two twin sisters, are an octave lower. Do I have a range or what, Terry?
You want to do one of the sisters?
Well, they happen to be my favorites.
Oh, that's great. You have a wonderful voice. Was your voice husky when you were young?
Yeah, I was born this way. I came out of my mom and said, hello, Rose. Hello, Dave.
But did you have a deep voice when you were young?
Yeah, they used to send me home. They always used to think I had laryngitis.
Oh, the nurses? Or...
Mm-hmm.
You have a very New York voice, but you grew up in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, Rose and Dave, who I just mentioned to you, my
parents, yeah.
They're from New York, and they taught me how to speak English, you see. So that's why I sound like this, as opposed to something lovely.
Julie Kavner, the voice of Marge Simpson, speaking to Terry Gross in 1994. After a break, we'll continue our 30th anniversary salute to The Simpsons by revisiting several more Fresh Air interviews. And movie critic David Edelstein reviews the newest entry in the Alien movie franchise, Alien Covenant. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Live from Springfield, the entertainment capital of the state, the Krusty Comeback Special.
Send in the clowns, those Daffy Laffy clowns. Send in those soulful and doleful schmaltz by the bowlful clowns. Send in the clowns.
I love you, Krusty.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Squarespace, where customers can get a Squarespace domain and showcase their creative ideas with a website, portfolio, or online store. Learn more at squarespace.com. And from Magoosh, online test prep for exams such as the ACT, SAT, and GRE. More at magoosh.com. Magoosh, prep smart, go far, enjoy the ride.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross, continuing our salute to The Simpsons, those lovable and durable orange-skinned characters who first appeared 30 years ago, in 1987, on Fox's The Tracy Ullman Show. They were featured as interstitial animated shorts, meant to serve as bumpers between the variety program's live-action comedy sketches and musical segments. 3 years later, in 1990, the weekly series known as The Simpsons was launched as a spinoff. 617 episodes later, they're still with us. Next up is Hank Azaria. This month, he wrapped up the first successful season of his own new live-action sitcom, playing a washed-up baseball announcer on the IFC series Brockmire. When Terry spoke with him in 2004, it was to discuss his many memorable roles on The Simpsons.
How did you get to be on The Simpsons? And two of the voices you do are Mo, the bartender, and Apu, who runs the convenience store, the Quickie Mart.
Yes, that's correct. Mo was the first voice I did. There's a little Mo for you there. And Apu was actually the third voice, I believe, that I did. And I was 22 years old. This was a long time ago. I'm 40 now. I was 22 years old, and hadn't worked much. There was an original voice of Mo the bartender that I guess they weren't too happy with. I wanted to replace. And I did this voice, and I was doing the play at the time in L.A. where I was playing a drug dealer, and I was sort of doing a bad Al Pacino impression in the play from Dog Day Afternoon. I was sort of talking like this, like kind of Al kind of sounded in Dog Day Afternoon. And I said, what about that voice? They're like, well, we want Mo to be gravelly. So I just made that voice gravelly, and it sounded like that. The next week I did Wiggum. Chief Wiggum, chief of police, talks like this. And then I did Apu, and then after about midway through the second season, they made me they gave me a contract. They made me a regular. By that point, I was doing like 5 or 10 voices.
Do you have a favorite Mo scene?
Favorite Mo scene? There's been a lot. He's one of my favorite characters. One of my favorite times is when Mo is asking a girl out. And he says to her that he's going to go out and buy her a steak the size of a toilet seat. That one sort of stayed with me.
How did you come up with the voice of Apu? He's an Indian in America who runs the Quickie Mart.
Correct. He really is just an Indian guy. I mean, in Los Angeles, pretty much every 7-Eleven or convenience store worker is either Indian or Pakistani or from this area. And when I first moved to LA, these were the people I really interacted with mostly because I didn't know anybody. So I would talk to these guys. He's also kind of loosely based on Peter Sellers' character from the film The Party. Peter Sellers in that movie plays a character named Hrundi V. Bakshi, and he's a very open, sweet, kind, innocent guy. So sort of Apu's personality is kind of based on that character.
You've had to sing as Apu?
I have had to sing as Apu, it's true.
Is it hard to sing in character?
It's much easier for me to sing in character. It's much more difficult for me to sing in my own voice. It's much easier for me to sing as Wiggum or as Apu or even as Mo.
Why is that?
I think I'm just more comfortable with you know, the mask, you know, and the vocal mask. You know, Chief Wiggum's like this. It's sort of easier to sing like this. than it is to sing. I'm not embarrassed to do that, but I'd be embarrassed to do the same thing in my own singing voice. It's weird.
That's Hank Azaria from his 2004 interview on Fresh Air. One of the classic episodes of The Simpsons, which has been a favorite in the Fresh Air office, is about Marge's crusade against cartoon violence. Here she is writing a letter to a TV executive played by Alex Rocco, who played Mo Green in The Godfather.
Dear purveyors of senseless violence, I know this may sound silly at first, but I believe that the cartoons you show to our children are influencing their behavior in a negative way. Please try to tone down the psychotic violence in your otherwise fine programming. Yours truly, Marge Simpson.
Take a letter, Miss White. Dear valued viewer, thank you for taking an interest in the Itchy and Scratchy program. Enclosed is a personally autographed photo of America's favorite cat and mouse team to add to your collection. In regards to your specific comments about the show, our research indicates that one person cannot make a difference, no matter how big a screwball she is. So let me close by saying...
And the horse I rode in on, I'll show them what one screwball can do.
Terry asked about that episode of The Simpsons when she interviewed Al Jean and Mike Reese in 1992. They're two of the original writers on the show and quickly became producers and showrunners. She asked why the writers had Marge campaign against cartoon violence.
The cartoons that they watched on The Simpsons, the Itchy and Scratchy show, were extremely violent. So she led a crusade and actually got them to tone down their violence. And the cartoons were really pathetic without violence. They were really lame. So kids didn't watch them, and then they went out and they started, riding bikes and building things and having fun. And, you know, it seemed like a golden age, but then... Michelangelo's David was going to tour Springfield, and then the same people that wanted to censor the cartoons wanted to put pants on the statue, and Marge realized that you can't really censor one thing without saying that censorship is okay in all forms. For a children's show, or, you know, quote-unquote children's show, it really had a lot to say.
Also, it's sort of typical of a Simpsons episode, which is it made a lot of points that all canceled each other out. The show really doesn't have a platform.
The other thing is we're sort of crusading against violent cartoons, but of course we got the show about 10 minutes of very violent cartoons, so we were kind of playing both ends against the middle.
Well, the violent cartoons that you show are Itchy and Scratchy, which kind of regularly appear in the series. And, I mean, all they do is just kind of, like, beat on each other with a hammer. I mean, that's the whole, there is no plot, or there's not even as much plot as there is in a Roadrunner cartoon.
No, in fact, they average about 6 seconds long. So if it was a real cartoon, you really wouldn't, you know, get much out of them.
We generally even spend longer writing the title of the cartoon than writing the rest of it. Something like Bang the Cat Slowly. was one title, and that took about 2 hours, and the rest of the cartoon was pretty easy to do.
Now, how do you work with the animators? Do you write the scripts first and then hand it over to them?
Yeah, the first thing we do is write the script and then record the audio track with the cast.
We record it like a radio show. It takes about 8 hours, and we cut it down to about 19 minutes of audio track. And then that's sent to the animators, who expand it to about 24 minutes.
We have a team of 6 guys who are terrific. They direct the way a movie director directs a feature. And, you know, they take the script and they pretty much stage the whole thing, design the characters. And then we see a real rough version in black and white called an animatic. We do some rewrites there. And then we send the whole thing to Korea. And that's where the actual color animation is done. It comes back about 3 months later.
You're really working far ahead.
It's sort of a good thing, which is, We throw in some topical allusions, but I think it's going to make the show a little more, it'll be a little timeless because we can't ride every current thing and get a quick laugh off of something that's in the news right now.
A bad thing that happens is we'll use a name like Rex Harrison or somebody, and then he'll die before the show airs, so we have to change it. It's sort of like there's a curse. And then we did a big joke about the Soviet Union and it died. So we have to just kind of be careful.
We had a little thing where Jackie Mason appeared on the show, and they flew to New York to record him, and he just made some reference to Isaac Bashevis Singer. And then a couple of months later, reading the paper, Isaac Bashevis Singer dies. Isaac Bashevis Singer dies. Oh, no. And we had to fly back to New York and get him to replace the line with Saul Bellow. And then for the next 2 months, we were praying, Saul Bellow, please don't die. And, you know, these prayers were going out to him, and I think he didn't know why.
As professional comedy writers, do you quip a lot around the house, like characters in sitcoms always do?
At home, it's more like, oh, I'm so tired. Oh, well, there's the baby. I better go say hello. We do have a lot of laughs around the office, but it's never about the script.
Yeah.
The fun stuff is always just talking about, you know, the elections or, you know, things that when we're wasting time and we're not, you know, doing things that are connected with the show, that's fun.
It's really as funny as it gets. It'll be rolling and everyone's laughing, and then someone's got to say, well, let's get back to those damn Simpsons.
Simpsons writers Al Jean and Mike Reese spoke with Terry Gross in 1992. Coming up, who needs the Quickie Mart? A Fish Called Selma? Trash of the Titans? Chief Wiggum P.I.? And Streetcar the Musical? We'll hear from Alf Clausen, who writes most of the music for The Simpsons. That's after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Grand Central Publishing, publisher of Testimony, the new novel by Scott Turow, about 400 people who have disappeared and one lawyer who wants answers. Testimony is available now. And from Home Instead Senior Care, offering customized in-home senior care services from bathing and medication reminders to Alzheimer's care. More at homeinstead.com/NPR.
This is Fresh Air.
Me through Hella, Stella, Stella!
have always depended on the kindness of strangers.
You can always depend on the kindness of strangers to walk up the spirit and shield you from dangers.
Now here's a tip from Blanche you won't regret.
O Streetcar is one of the many terrific song parodies written by Alf Clausen, who composes and arranges most of the music on The Simpsons. In 1997, Terry asked him how he works with the writers of The Simpsons, who come up with the lyrics.
It's a collaborative effort in creating the songs. I'm usually given a set of script pages that contain the lyric, and I'm usually given enough pages in front of the lyric and behind the lyric so that I know what the setup of the scene is supposed to be. And once I'm given the lyric, I'll be in conference with the producers, and I'll get a scan from them as to the pacing of the lyric, what the intent of the scene is, what the ambiance of the song should be.
Let me move to another track on The Simpsons' Songs in the Key of Springfield CD. And you wrote a theme for the Springfield news show, Eye on Springfield, with Kent Brockman.
Right.
Tell me about writing this theme and what you think of TV themes and news themes that you hear.
I think that my take on TV news themes in general now is that somewhere along the way there has been a god of rock and roll that has reached down and grabbed every news director by the neck and said, our news theme must contain rock and roll, and our news theme must be synthesized, because that's what the public relates to now. It gives us all this excitement, and that's what I tried to reach for in the Eye on Springfield theme. The rock groove plus the electronic synthesized music that everybody's come to know and love.
Well, let's hear your version of this, the Eye on Springfield theme with Kent Brockman.
Hello, I'm Kent Brockman, and this is Eye on Springfield. Infotainment.
I want to get to another song on the Simpsons CD. This is actually a parody of a song from Schoolhouse Rock, the song I'm Just a Bill on Capitol Hill. And this was a song written by Dave Frischberg that's supposed to describe, I mean, that does describe how a bill becomes a law. And this is a really clever parody of that by a demagogue, you know, sung in the persona of a demagogue. And Jack Sheldon, who the trumpeter who sang the original version, sings this one as well. Tell us how this one came about.
Well, again, the lyric originated as part of the script, and when I was given the sample that this was supposed to follow, when I heard the original, my first comment was, well, that's Jack Sheldon singing. And the producer said, do you know him? And I said, oh, yes, he's a friend of mine. He's worked for me many times in the past. He worked for me on Moonlighting, playing some of his beautiful, beautiful trumpet solos. He's one of the best jazz trumpet players in the world. And I said, wouldn't it be funny if we could get Jack to sing on our parody as well as the original? And the comment was made of, do you think we'd be able to get him? And I said, sure, let me make the call. I called Jack, and Jack said, I'd be glad to do this. So it really, I think, makes it come that much closer to home and gives the bite that much more significance.
What did you have to do musically to make it not exactly what the original song is? I mean, Dave Frischberg, who wrote the original, probably wasn't going to sue you, but is that the kind of thing you have to worry about?
It's an interesting challenge. By the way, Dave's an old friend of mine. He and I used to play casuals together when I was still playing.
Casuals?
And before he... Casuals. weddings, dances, and stuff like that. I was a bass player. He's a piano player. And we played some jobs together before he moved to New York and became a famous songwriter. It's always an interesting challenge to try to walk the line of creating an homage to someone, but not duplicating it note for note. Obviously, I'm always concerned about the fact that what I want to do is original, but nevertheless brings back the ambiance of the selected parody piece. It's tricky, but I think we got it to work.
Well, let's hear the parody of I'm Just a Bill. The parody is called The Amendment Song, and this is from an episode of The Simpsons called The Day the Violence Died.
Hey, who left all this garbage on the steps of Congress?
I'm not garbage. I'm an amendment to be. Yes, an amendment to be. And I'm hoping that they'll ratify me. There's a lot of flag burners who have got too much freedom. I want to make it legal for policemen to beat them, cause there's limits to our liberties. At least I hope and pray that there are, cause those liberal freaks go too far.
But why can't we just make a law against flag burning?
Because that law would be unconstitutional. But if we change the Constitution,
then we could make all sorts of crazy laws.
Now you're catching on.
What the hell is this?
It's one of those campy 70s throwbacks that appeals to Generation Xers.
We need another Vietnam to thin out their ranks a little.
What if people say you're not good enough to be in the Constitution?
Then I'll crush all opposition to me, and I'll make Ted Kennedy pay. If he fights back, I'll say that he's gay.
Amendment, they ratified ya. You're in the U.S. Constitution.
Oh, yeah. Doors open, boys.
When you're writing a song parody, you're trying to write it as if it were serious, as if it were really a Broadway show or really a movie theme.
Absolutely. Not only in creating the songs, but in creating the underscore music for The Simpsons and trying to give credence to the emotional content of what the characters are saying, I'm always extremely serious. And I think what happens is that the listener and observer gets pulled into the situation more effectively once the music is serious, so that when the gag finally comes, the gag then becomes twice as funny.
Alf Clausen, composer and arranger of most of the music on The Simpsons. Matt Groening's animated Simpsons family members made their first appearance 30 years ago on Fox's The Tracy Ullman Show and have had their own weekly half-hour comedy series since 1990. Happy anniversary. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews the latest movie in the sci-fi Alien series, Alien Covenant. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The Alien film cycle began in 1979 with Ridley Scott's sci-fi horror movie Alien. It was a huge hit, followed by three sequels. There also was a prequel in 2012 called Prometheus. Now Scott is back to direct another prequel called Alien Covenant. Michael Fassbender plays two different androids, and the rest of the cast includes Catherine Waterston and Danny McBride. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Once seen, there's no way to forget the title creature of Ridley Scott's 1979 film Alien, now making its comeback in Alien Covenant. Conceived by writers Dan O'Bannon and Ronald Shusett, and designed by H.R. Giger, it was the sum of all fears, the mascot of the subgenre called body horror. The alien impregnated its victims, who were then eviscerated, giving birth. Its blood was acid. It was steely and drippy, a fusion, in the words of one conceptual artist, of phallic symbols and motorcycle parts. Some people wondered, how could such a killing machine have evolved? I wasn't one of those people, but plenty of them flocked to the 2012 film Prometheus, for which Ridley Scott returned. It was a prequel. It took place before the events of the first Alien, but irritated audiences by the general absence of, well, aliens. Alien Covenant, also directed by Scott, is a different kettle of maggots. It has all the face-grabbing, stomach-busting blood and guts you'd want, while answering that existential question, from whence came this thing? Here's the setup. It's some years after Prometheus, but still before the events of the first Alien. Covenant is the name of a spaceship heading to a hospitable planet in a distant galaxy, carrying thousands of colonists in suspended animation and a handful of crew members. As the movie begins, there's some kind of cosmic burst that damages the ship. So an android named Walter, played by Michael Fassbender, wakes the crew and saves the vessel, though its commander goes up in flames. Having mourned the dead, crew members are set to go back to cryosleep for about a decade when they pick up a faint human signal from a nearby habitable planet. Billy Crudup plays the replacement commander, who identifies as a man of faith rather than science, and he thinks they should head for that closer planet. The original commander's widow, Daniels, played by Catherine Waterston, thinks it's a bad idea. Not to spoil anything, but if it were a good idea, this wouldn't be an alien movie. So you begin to wait for stuff like this.
Captain, come in. Do you copy?
Guys, look out! Cool?
It looks even worse than it sounds. Alien Covenant is plodding and repetitious, with dull stretches between the scenes of screaming and splatter, although that was true of the first Alien, too. This one's nowhere near as original, or invasive, or as ferociously exciting as James Cameron's first sequel, Aliens. But the movie does deliver. It's not a cheat. Catherine Waterston makes a soulful protagonist, human rather than superhuman, and Danny McBride is fun as a mouthy officer who calls himself Tennessee. The film's real focus, though, isn't human or alien, but fascinatingly enough, android. In the last film, Prometheus, we met Michael Fassbender's David, an android with a chip on his shoulder bigger than the ones inside him. He's back in Alien Covenant. He's living on that deadly planet. And suddenly, he's face to face with Walter, his brother android from the Covenant. What do they make of each other? Well, Walter is the next generation of android. He's been stripped of some of David's pesky human emotions and thinks himself superior. But David, it turns out, has a powerful agenda. Without giving too much away, I can say that Alien Covenant turns out to have two distinct progenitors. One is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which incidentally had the subtitle The Modern Prometheus. The other is the spate of books and films in which machines evolve to the point where they wipe out humanity. The Terminator is a prime example, and so is The Matrix, although the machines in that one kept humans around to use their bodies as batteries. Laugh all you like at those sci-fi scenarios, but no less than Stephen Hawking recently said he gives humans 100 more years before artificially intelligent entities take us out. Worse news yet, when those machines see Alien Covenant, they're going to get some spectacularly yucky ideas.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. On Monday's show, Thomas Ricks covered the Pentagon for the Washington Post and wrote the bestseller Fiasco about the Iraq War. He says his new book, Churchill and Orwell, is about two men who didn't put politics ahead of the facts. He'll talk about them and also give us his impression of three powerful military men in the Trump administration, Generals Mattis, McMaster, and Kelly, men he's covered. Also, I review the new Twin Peaks. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Whole Foods Market, offering drinks, snacks, and grilling staples. Recipes for Memorial Day meals are available at wholefoodsmarket.com. Whole Foods Market, we believe in real food. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, the federal agency that supports the arts and creativity in communities across the nation. More information is available at arts.gov.